call this meeting of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. Time is now 3:31, Tuesday, January 28th, 2025. We are in Butrovich, room 205. Members present are Senator Hughes, Senator Klayman, Vice Chair Giesel, and myself, Chair Dunbar. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, I would like to thank Mary Gwen Kawakami, the Senate Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, and Marnie Provost from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We have a full agenda today. We have the introduction of two bills. First, Senate Bill 45, Medicaid Mental Health Parity, by myself, Chair Dunbar, and then Senate Bill 44, Minors in Psychiatric Hospitals, by Senator Klayman. We will hold invited testimony after each introduction and hold the bills for further deliberation. We will not be holding public testimony on either bill today. So, our first item is Senate Bill 45, which I have sponsored. We're going to have that introduction today and invited testimony and set the bill aside for further consideration. Arielle Wiggin, the Senate Health Committee aide, will introduce the bill and present a brief sectional analysis, and then we will have a longer presentation from the Behavioral Health Association, followed by invited testimony. We have, let's see here, in the room we have Chris Constant from the Municipality of Anchorage and Dustin Larna from the Residential Youth Care in Ketchikan. I believe they will be here for invited testimony. Dustin is here or not. And then on the phone, we should have Lance Johnson, the Vice President of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. I don't see them on my tablet. Do we have him? Okay, we don't have him yet. Oh, you're here. This is you in the back there. Okay, wonderful. Even better. In the room. So, Ms. Wiggin, why don't you begin with the bill introduction?
For the record, my name is Arielle Wiggin, and I'm Chief of Staff to Senator Dunbar and Committee Aide for this committee. I will keep our sponsor statement extraordinarily brief, as we have many subject matter experts in this room, but essentially this, we have an opportunity as a legislature to increase access to behavioral health care in a way that will deeply affect many of our communities. Almost a quarter of Alaska residents participate in some form of Medicaid or have a family member who does so, and the arduousness of acquiring behavioral health care is something that is affecting our family members, our communities, and our schools. I will leave the rest of the peculiarities of this bill to our subject matter experts, and I'll move on to our sectional analysis, if that's okay with the committee. Senate Bill 45 begins with Section 1. This section states that the state must provide equal coverage and access to treatment for behavioral health issues. It is a new subsection I to the state statute that governs services provided to Medicaid recipients, which is AS 477030. The new subsection says the Department of Health must follow federal behavioral health parity statutes, and these are listed in the bill. The second section describes how the Commissioner of Health will comply with relevant parts of the federal behavioral health law and how they will investigate claims about failure to comply with parity and behavioral health coverage. This is a new section to state Medicaid statute. Section 3 creates a reporting requirement that will notify the legislature by March 1st every year of what the department's process for medical necessity means for both behavioral and mental health coverage. It will list the rules limiting behavioral health care and physical health care, both in a numerical and non-numerical sense. It will describe the criteria used to define these benefits. And Section 4 requires the Commissioner of Health to submit a one-time report describing how the department is transitioning into behavioral health parity. This is required to be online. It's required to be written in non-technical, plain language. And it is required to both summarize market review conducted for compliance with this piece of legislation and how the state has evaluated if Alaska's Medicaid program complies with federal behavioral health parity law. There's three new sections added to uncodified law, one of which is Section 5 of this bill. It requires the Department of Health to submit necessary amendments to the federal government for approval. Section 6 specifies that Sections 1 through 4 will only take effect if the federal government approves those amendments to our state Medicaid plan. And Section 7 says that Section 1 through 4 will take effect the day after they grant approval. That is all I have for our sectional, and I'd love to move on to those who know best in the room.
Thank you, Ms. Wiggin. Any questions? I concur with Ms. Wiggin that I believe that the Behavioral Health Association will be better equipped to answer some of the specifics. So with everyone's indulgence, we'll ask Mr. Johnson to come up and begin their presentation. I should know for the record, we also have, I believe, members from the Department of Health here that are available to answer questions. They will not be presenting today. All right, Mr. Johnson, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Senator. Lance Johnson, the COO for the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. Appreciate having this time here with everybody. We do have folks on the phone who are going to be supporting this presentation. Really appreciate the time that this committee has given. Yes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson. We have a request to go briefly at ease.
Nexus Conference Manager, please enter conference ID followed by the pound key or press star 00 to speak with an operator.
Hi, Lance.
How are you? Good to see you.
If you are the conference host, press 1. Please enter your PIN followed by the pound key. His conference is in lecture.
All right. Back on the record, Health Social Services Committee. I'll note for the record, we were joined by Senator Tobin a number of minutes ago, about 3:33. So, Mr. Johnson, if you would please proceed with your presentation.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And thank you again to the committee for having us. We've talked for the last couple of years on parity, so we're very happy to have this opportunity again and appreciate the chair, Senator Dunbar, for sponsoring this bill. We have along with us some folks on the phone who are going to offer some testimony. I know you mentioned Dustin Larna. He should be on the conference call here. But I also want to take the time to introduce John Solomon. He's the CEO of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. And for the record as well, I know I was introduced as the VP of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. Just for the record, I'm COO for that, if that makes a difference. And so I want to go ahead and, John, if you are online, if you want to introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm here, if you can hear me. My name is John Solomon. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. Is everybody able to hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Mr. Solomon. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Dunbar. And thank you to the Senate committee. I am thankful that I get to be here virtually. As many folks in the room know, that I'm on the countdown to a new baby, so I have had to limit my travel, so I appreciate being able to come in virtually here. Just as a background to the Behavioral Health Association, we're the association that represents, it's about 109 member organizations right now that deal with behavioral health in the state, and most of them direct service providers, and most of them also dealing with Medicaid. So, and then beyond that, I'm a professional counselor, licensed professional counselor. I was a QA supervisor training clinicians and on regulations, and then a director of behavioral health at Manelik up in Kotzebue before this. So, and then last but not least, I'm also a person in long-term recovery. So I feel like I have a varied experience at behavioral health, and so I hope I can answer some questions. What I wanted to do was just do a real basic look at parity. I think it's a good place to level set what parity is and what it isn't. So, Lance, I trust that you're following along and able to adjust the slides as you hear me talk.
Yes, sir.
But what I'm going to talk. Sorry if I spoke over somebody there. A brief idea of what parity is. Parity is just ensuring that behavioral health treatment has the same access and coverage as medical and surgical treatments, really, you know, that's really basic, but it gets a little bit more complicated when you think that behavioral health services happen in multiple settings. So, you know, they can happen in a hospital, they can happen in FQHC, and then they can happen in community behavioral health settings, which is where really what we're talking about right now is behavioral health that happens in a community behavioral health setting. So what parity legislation doesn't do is it doesn't limit the ability of the state to regulate or manage the Medicaid program. It's really just asking the state to analyze how it does that compared to how it regulates and manages the medical Medicaid program. So it doesn't remove any oversight. It doesn't remove accreditation standards. It doesn't change clinical practice. And really any work processes that would change would just be to the benefit of making sure that we're following the same standards. So it just allows the state to kind of analyze what it's doing and allows us to see that analysis and understand. So the main thing is that we hope it would do is it would allow the state to understand where the barriers to care are and remove some of those barriers. And when I talk about barriers to care, a lot of what we're seeing in community behavioral health is just these outdated regulations that were really born out of kind of grant language that before behavioral health was able to be billed to Medicaid, it was kind of a grant-based care. And so the language was a lot more prescriptive about how to do it. And that really hasn't kept up with the fact that we can bill Medicaid now that it is, you know, evidence-based, that, you know, there's clinical decision-making that has to happen in behavioral health. So, you know, a lot of that is that required paperwork, the oversight, you know, these documentation standards that don't fit clinical, like the clinical practice, the clinical decision-making. And so in parity legislation, they talk about this thing called, which is you know, trying to not use technical language, but this is outlined in parity legislation. It's a thing called non-quantitative treatment limiters, which it just means non-number kind of limitations. So things that limit care that isn't based in, like, you're allowed this many. So it would be things like regulations that are different in community behavioral health care than community health care that make it just harder to get into community behavioral health care. And, you know, like, a 1,000-foot overview of that is really – It's based on that stigma that you know, behavioral health providers need to provide more evidence that the decision that they're making fits in line with evidence-based practice. So we're not saying throw out, you know, clinical best practice. We're actually just trying to align it better so that we can practice clinically, which makes sense with our scope of practice, our licensure and things. So those are just some of the barriers that are highlighted across the country, but in Alaska, we're actually, there's a federal warning signs document that outlines specific things that Alaska Medicaid is doing. So we just want to make sure that the state has the ability to design some tools and regulate that. And then report out to the legislature about how they're doing that. So I'm not going to try and overly simplify this, but to kind of look at how it affects a client when they walk in the door. If we looked at what traditionally people would call physical health, you know, if you're going to a community health center or an FQHC or an outpatient, you can do a lot in one appointment. That, you know, if you have like a hurt elbow and you're going to walk in and you're going to do your intake, you're going to get a brief assessment right there, perhaps some immediate treatment. I know that there are some medical providers on the committee, so I don't want to overstate or oversimplify. But from there, you know, you might develop an ongoing plan, a plan to get further assessment, but you're able to kind of work clinically as to what walks in your door. In a community behavioral health center, which could be just across the street or just a separate door in the same building, there's these regulations that kind of list how treatment goes. And so you start with intakes and screenings, and then you go into this full assessment with a biopsychosocial assessment, which would then inform what your treatment plan is, which is a 90-day treatment plan, and signatures are required on whether you're, you know, a minor or an adult. There's different signature requirements. which could include, you know, people from school or, you know, guardians and such. And then by that time, you're finally able to get to treatment. Now, as, you know, this is laid out, I've laid it out here on this slide as four appointments, because that is often how many times it does take to get to treatment. Now, as a, you know, as a clinician myself, UA supervisor training clinicians, I mean, I could bang out an assessment and, you know, do an intake and screening and maybe get their treatment plan all done in one appointment that was 2.5 hours total, you know, and that's what we're asking people when they walk in the doors, just to get to that treatment. We're talking hours of work. And this, if it's split up across appointments, this is when it takes months. It can be, you know, 6 months to get an assessment, because these assessments are really intensive and long. And this is how clients end up saying, I don't want to go through this again, or, you know, it's easier for me to go to the emergency room, you know. So we end up with a system where the people that need to get into community behavioral health center are diverting to things like the emergency room, because they get care right away, they get treatment right away. So, but that's just what you see on the front end of things. And so I'm going to turn it back over to Lance, because if I paint with broad strokes, Lance is much more detail oriented. And there's a whole side of things that is behind the scenes that community behavioral health providers have to do that doesn't match with our community physical health providers. So Lance, if you could just take over from here, if that's all right.
You bet, John. Thanks. And I appreciate how you've outlined that, John. I know we've seen this a few times before, but we're always changing it because the circumstances continue to change. I want to illustrate something before I talk about the things that the providers have to do and administrative staff have to do behind the scenes, just to illustrate the physical and the behavioral. John said that sometimes it's easier for people to go to the emergency room to get that help because it's too hard to get into behavioral health services because of the barriers that are there. Give you a real-world example. I worked at an agency in Nome for 11 and a half years as the behavioral health services director, and we had a psychiatrist who worked on the community behavioral health services side. That psychiatrist had to work through all of the same documentation requirements that are required by regulation that a master's level clinician had to do, that, in fact, a behavioral health aide had to do, a little bit more limited, but still having to jump through the same hoops. We moved that psychiatrist over to the medical side because people could get in to see the psychiatrist immediately, almost immediately, and the requirements for the documentation and regulations on the medical side were completely different, less onerous than it was on the community behavioral health side. So it made sense to give people more access to the psychiatrist than they were getting coming through community behavioral health services. Me personally, I have depression and anxiety. I forgot my propranolol before I came up here too, so I'm surprised I'm actually talking decently enough. But I go to a psychiatrist to go ahead and get my medications through a medical side of things. I don't go through the community behavioral health services side because of what I've already outlined here and what John's outlined. The thing that I'm missing is the talk therapy that I need that I can only get on the community behavioral health services side. So it's great that the psychiatrist can ask me how I'm doing and how my meds are doing, but it becomes a real barrier when I want to go deeper and talk about some of the things that are contributing to my depression or to my anxiety, and we can't get there. So I go to the community behavioral health services side, and now I've got two different types of providers who are operating under two different systems, which makes it really difficult and confusing for clients who are going to utilize those services. So that's just for the client side that makes it confusing, but for the behavioral health provider side and the administrative side of those provider agencies, Medicaid enrollment is a very convoluted thing for the community behavioral health services side. There are many hoops to jump through and many different provider types that have to be considered when enrolling in Medicaid. And then there's a whole system of claims adjudication that is very different in some respects from the medical and surgical side, where there's a payer of services was before for the behavioral health services side that wasn't doing Medicaid or doing the medical side. And so it became, when, particularly when you're an agency that has both medical services and behavioral health services, you're billing two different systems, which makes it difficult for me because of the documentation requirements. I couldn't have our clinicians dedicate too much time to that because we want to see as many clients as we could. I had to hire three different staff members on the administrative side to do the entry for the required data points that are needed by the state, so the clinicians didn't have to do that. But that's three FTEs I had to take away from the clinical side in order to manage that. So you're balancing these documentation standards. And again, it's difficult when you're, say, an FQHC and you're a community behavioral health services provider. You're operating under two different systems of care. And then it just with some of the other behind-the-scenes stuff, there is the state reporting. There's accreditation that is required of the community behavioral health services providers. It's an unfunded mandate as well, so that can get quite pricey and expensive. But it's more time. So no exaggeration, I wish I were. The last accreditation survey I did when I was in Nome, I worked 31 days straight just to get that together and making sure. Now, it was during COVID, so that presented a real challenge, too, on how they did the survey. But that's what it took my time away from being able to do other things that I need to manage a whole agency. I think, for the record, accreditation is a good thing. Don't hear me wrong. I think it made our organization stronger. But again, it's another layer that makes it really difficult to provide those clinical services. I'm not going to go through this. Just the red column are the things that community behavioral health services have to do as far as regulations and some of the things that are required in documentation. And the green columns are for FQHCs and for HPGs, or health professional groups. And keep in mind, this was before we made the transition for Optum in the state. But a lot of this is still the same. You can just see how much longer the red column is than the green columns for things that are required of community behavioral health services. And there's approximately 117 pages of different things that behavioral health providers have to look through, service manuals for 1115 services, and make sure that they're complying with the services there and how they need to be implemented, and then also with just the regulations themselves. Compared to the medical and surgical side, where there's just a couple pages of regulations. They have separate regulations that, govern the medical side, but as far as documentation goes, 105.230 is about a page and a half long. And while behavioral health providers can operate under that, they have another whole set of regulations that say you have to do these documents as well under Chapter 135. So you're again, compounding the system, and it's providing that barrier to care. When you're doing all this administrative stuff. So we know that the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act in 2008 outlined some different things that federally said, hey, these are the things, and John mentioned it, these non-quantitative treatment limiters or limitations that say, hey, don't do this. Don't do a time-based treatment plan because this is a barrier to care. And it said, you know, don't do service authorizations necessarily because, again, it's a barrier to care. These are not the best ways to go ahead and do care. Those two things I just mentioned, treatment plans and service authorizations aren't clinically necessary. They don't provide clinical information. They're used for medical necessity, supposedly, but it's not that. It's checking to make sure that there's no fraud, there's no waste, that type of thing for the most part. And so the state has been great. They've done a great job. During COVID, it afforded us an opportunity to see what it would be like, the system, how it would function without the requirement for service authorizations. And to the credit of the division, they've really worked hard to keep those service authorizations from having to pop up for most services. And I commend them for that, for sure. But time-based treatment plans, again, don't have any clinical bearing. Treatment plans are important, like plans of care on the medical side. But having them time-based and saying you have to do this every 90 days doesn't make clinical sense. A lot of providers are going to be doing it with every visit. But you have to document it because it's embedded in regulation. And not to get into payments too much, but if you miss that 90-day window because, say, somebody's out doing subsistence and can't make their group and can't make their time to get into the clinic to go ahead and sign their treatment plan – you're providing services without being reimbursed for them. that shouldn't be the way it is. We can provide more services, the more that we can get reimbursed for services. But we're not pioneers in this area when it comes to parity. As John said, we're a fee-for-service state. So the state of Alaska is not beholden to parity laws, but it can go ahead and govern the regulations over Medicaid. It can align it with the Federal Parity Act. And again, we're not pioneers. This has happened already in Wyoming, New Mexico, Maine, some other states that we have where they've made this work. And the reason that we want to do this now, we talked about this last year, and we were very grateful to have a parity resolution that got passed saying, let's work together. We urge the state to go ahead and look at ways to make parity a reality here. And I think the reason we're looking at a bill, and not I think, but the reason we're looking at a bill is to a couple reasons. One, we have a really good, I believe, the association has a really good relationship with the state in working with the Department of Health and working with the Division of Behavioral Health. And there are things that we've already collaborated on that's really promising for what the landscape's going to look like for behavioral health. We have a long way to go, but we both entities recognize that. We understand that, these are baby steps we have to take because the system has been stuck in this place for 25, 30 years for behavioral health. But it's encouraging because we're working together. But the bill also being put in place says, hey, Lance, if you're not here tomorrow or, Director Dompling, you retire or whatever the case may be, we can have whole administrations change. And then we're back to square one. And so it's really important to get something into legislation so that we can continue to work on this past our time that we're serving the communities and serving the state.
Mr. Johnson, I'm just going to pause for a second and say we're a little pressed for time because we have another bill, and I know there are some time constraints on some of our testifiers. So you have two more slides, and if you could go through them a little bit faster, I'd
appreciate it.
You
betcha. Thank you. All that passion's coming out now. Thank you, Chair. So in the long run, if we can go ahead and work together to get the parity in place, get more access to services because it's not spending more time on administrative time, there's less dependency on the emergency room, which we know is expensive, and we know it's not suited for a lot of the behavioral health issues that may come in through that door. Correction system. I'll tell you right now, 95% of the folks, not, this is not anecdotal, this is a statistic, 95% 3 years ago in the Norton Sound region of folks who went into Anvil Mountain Correctional Center were in there for violations that involved substances. $141 a day for 128 beds, $6.6 million for the population in there, $6.3 million at 95%. That's what's being spent on folks not being able to get the treatment that they need to. And so you think about these windows. If somebody has to wait who has a substance use issue, that window is very narrow to get in there before they change their mind. So that's all the more reason. This is a residual effect. If we can get people diverted into treatment services sooner, then we're gonna free up a lot of these other resources. And the rest you can see there. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to John for the final piece here. Thank you.
Mr. Solomon.
You able to hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Yeah, and I'll just be quick. I think that we have we are able to answer questions. I think the sectional analysis does a good job of just outlining that none of this legislation, it doesn't do anything specifically to change this. It allows for the state to ensure compliance to the standards that they can go through and make the decisions based on medical necessity and oversight and how it relates to medical care. So that's what we're asking with this legislation. We really appreciate Senator Dunbar, you putting this forward. And with that, in the interest of time, I'm available to answer anybody's questions, or if you want to get deeper into the weeds, I'm happy to talk with you offline as well.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I don't see any questions, but this is a complicated piece of legislation. I mean, ultimately, the goal is simple, but the implementation might be challenging. And so we don't intend to move it today, and there will certainly be conversations both offline and here at the committee about ways that the hopefully the Behavioral Health Association and the Department of Health can get in line together. So with that, thank you for this presentation.
Thank
we'll
you.
Move on to invited testimony.
Thank you.
So first up, we have Assembly Chair Chris Constant from the Municipality of Anchorage, although I'm not sure if you're speaking in that capacity today. We want to come forward and put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Christopher Constant. I serve as Chair of the Anchorage Assembly, and I also wear a separate hat as the Director of Strategic Growth for Aquila Incorporated, which is a statewide provider of behavioral health care and a member of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. And so in our conversations, it kind of fell upon me as the natural to speak to this because I've spent approximately 30 years or so, most of my time in Alaska, somehow associated with the behavioral health care field. In fact, my first job when I moved up here straight out of college was a counselor at a residential treatment program for youth back in the Denali Kid Care days when the ARCH program was one of the primary providers of these services. And so Aquila has been a provider for the last 50 years. I put that on the record because I want to make sure people know that I am speaking on behalf of the Assembly, but I will probably reference my experience at Aquila. So today I'm here to voice strong support for SB 45. It's a bill that will ensure mental health and substance use disorder benefits under Medicaid are treated the same with fairness as physical health benefits. Let me paint a picture for you first. We just heard a conversation about qualitative versus non-qualitative screening tools for the service provision and determination of whether the benefits are warranted. Medical necessity. So Aquila runs a program called Stepping Stones, and it's a program for pregnant and parenting women with young children in which they get to stay integrated with their children while they go through a residential treatment program. Historically, that program might take 6 to 9 months to a year, year and a half. Under the managed care model, they've been told you have 90 days. Then you have to come back and get a new service authorization. Now imagine you are a pregnant woman who is suffering from an addiction to an opiate. You've made the decision to change your life. Aquila, after going through that whole screening process you saw, has said you can come into this program. It takes you 30 days to get into that building and get settled and get your life established and be able to figure out the rhythm of your new life. Then in 30 days after that, you have to start your transition planning because the health management system says at 90 days you should be done with this treatment experience. It's not even enough time to get in and get stabilized, let alone get treatment, get your life in order, get new habits and patterns established, and be able to move on successfully into the community. And without that kind of support, that's bad for the mother, that's bad for the child, that's bad for the community. It's just bad. And so I think there's a lot to be said about the changes the legislature's been implementing. In particular, the 1115 waiver has been a boon to our system because it has provided, I would call, a fluorescence of new vendors who are able to qualify and provide services, which creates competition, which creates an opportunity for more people to get in. We're no longer struggling for a lack of, quote, beds. We struggle for a lack of staff, which is a completely different problem, but it's a much better problem than having no place at the inn. And I'm sorry I'm speaking so quickly. I was told to keep it kind of brief, so I'm going to try to get all this in the record. 16 pages, no, just two, actually. So the reality is the waiver, as it has been implemented, has been a boon, but it doesn't do anything for equitability of the services available in our system as a whole, right? It doesn't bring to parity the level of services available to the community. Instead, it provides the venue and the opportunity, but it doesn't create the effort to make sure that those services are treated in the same way as other healthcare services. So the reality is this bill will ensure that progress is made from the waiver to undo some inequities that have occurred and will create a comprehensive and equitable behavioral healthcare system for Alaskans. This bill is good for Alaskans, the people of our state. It directly benefits people by creating equal access to care. It will ensure that mental health and substance use disorder benefits have the same priority as physical health care, removing these discriminatory barriers that have long prevented people from receiving essential services. The legislation will lead to, I guarantee it, will lead to improved mental health outcomes across the state. Why? Because people will have access. They will no longer be turned away. There will be a place to go. Can you guess what in Anchorage the number one waiting room for behavioral health care services is in our community, other than the jails?
I was gonna say the jails.
Other than the jails. That's the easy one. It's the streets of our city. It's the parks of our city. It's people don't have a place to go, and it is a tragedy that's happening. I can remember back in 2015, the summer of spice, we call it, when people were cycling between in front of shelter to the hospital and back three times a day. People in Catatonia standing there waiting for a day that was never going to come. And I could take this story back to 1998. My first job in Alaska, my second job was at Aquila. So I've had association with this company for almost 30 years. When I was working on the API replacement project, I don't know that anybody here was involved with the legislature at that time, but there was a decision made where we were going to reduce the number of beds at API, replace the facility, and implement community-based supports. We got the first half right. We got the hospital in half. It's a beautiful facility, but we really didn't get the investment in the community-based supports right. This gets closer to fulfilling the promise. In fact, if you couple this with the waiver and the expansion of the opportunities for services, we start to get to where you can see a mental health crisis response system emerging through all of the challenges that we've faced. Families will benefit from this because the burdens will reduce on them financially. And most importantly, SB 45 will work to reduce stigma. It still exists that if you are an individual who's maybe new to the behavioral healthcare system because you have a family member who just had an emerging mental health diagnosis, there is stigma. It is just undeniable. And the stigma is compounded when you have to go through four visits to get into a service provider in order to receive the support that you need. In fact, again, putting the Aquila hat back on, we recently made a proposal and we're funded by the division for a service that you wouldn't think would be unique. We call it after hours assessment. That first step, getting assessed so you can be seen. Nobody in the state is offering assessments after five or on the weekends. You can't get in the door if you have your crisis and your moment of clarity on Saturday. So we decided we were going to try to fix that. Aquila did. And that is an emerging program under the opioid mitigation funding that the legislature has put out there. And so really, by treating mental health and substance use services as central components of healthcare, this bill sends a powerful message. Mental health is health. This cultural shift is critical to encouraging more Alaskans to seek the care that they need. It's also good for the provider. SB 45 is vital for the sustainability of behavioral health providers in Alaska. The legislation will introduce streamlined oversight and compliance mechanisms by creating transparency in the Medicaid processes and reducing the administrative barriers that are pretty intense. You saw the list from the Behavioral Health Association, all of those things. And it changes so constantly, whether we're talking about Xerox. Some of you were probably here when Xerox was the provider. Right, and then we went to Optum, and now we're kind of in this brave new world. You know, Xerox, the organization I worked for, left us holding the bag for over a year on our billable services, and we had to take out a line of credit over $1 million just to keep the lights on while we waited. Eventually, it got worked out. We need to make sure that those kind of circumstances don't happen again, and if we have a system that is developed in parity with the medical system, it will work better because then you have an entire new force of advocacy to keep things aligned. Additionally, SB 45 supports the growth of Alaska's behavioral health workforce. Like the waiver, this will improve the financial and operational environment for providers. As I spoke before, the challenge of opening beds right now is not capital beds. It's people, professionals, to make sure that those beds are operating. This will help to undo some of the burden that have been created where we're shifting staff into administrative roles instead of in clinical roles. And it will make Alaska more attractive for behavioral health providers, people who are inherent care providers, right? They've made their profession caring, but they run away from having to chase paper because chasing paper doesn't help provide care. It just helps to make sure fidelity with the requirements, which is good. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's a good thing. As a member of the municipal government, I can say we want to make sure fidelity is also applied. And I'm almost done. So for local governments, this will also provide some benefit, substantial benefit. I can attest to the significant strain untreated behavioral health issues place on our local governments, our local communities, our parks, our neighbors, and our neighborhoods. Untreated behavioral health needs are one of the critical issues of our time. And in fact, the municipality has adopted a behavioral health care plank of our annual legislative program. So we're not asking for money. We're asking for help in fixing these problems. And this thing fits right square in the Venn diagram of what we're looking at. In Anchorage, we see this unmet need in our jails, our emergency rooms, our shelters, as individuals cycle through these systems without adequate access to the care that they need. SB 45 will reduce pressure on municipal resources by ensuring that Medicaid funds timely and effective behavioral treatment services. This will help prevent crises that require costly interventions by police, fire, and emergency services. And by addressing these problems upstream, we'll be able to provide, I believe, a cost savings for the municipality and the state in the long run. When Medicaid ensures access to behavioral health care, local governments spend less on safety net programs. We're able to spend those resources on other critical needs. Finally, for the state of Alaska, the benefits of SB 45 are very clear to me. By aligning Alaska's Medicaid program with federal parity laws, SB 45 will ensure compliance and positions Alaska to maximize federal funding opportunities today, notwithstanding, bringing additional resources into the state's healthcare system. It will create long-term cost savings for the state by lining these systems up. That's my belief. It will also provide additional transparency and accountability that will ensure that Medicaid dollars are spent effectively with annual reporting requirements, providing a clear picture of how behavioral health services are delivered in the state, fostering good governance and public trust. I would conclude by saying SB 45, although Chair Dunbar says it's complex, it's very simple in the end. It is a reporting system. It's an adoption of a system of regs that will address longstanding inequities in our state. It will ensure parity between behavioral health and physical health services, and it will improve outcomes for individuals. It will support behavioral health providers and reduce strain on our local government. And as chair of the Anchorage Assembly and director of strategic growth at Aquila, I urge you to pass this bill. I understand that there might be some disagreements between the administration and the legislature at this time, and that's okay. The creative fermentation of ideas, they improve if done right when you work together. It might be that this part can go, or we need to look at these regulations differently. I urge the administration to look closely and support this effort because it will provide a benefit for all of us. It will help to make our streets a safer and better place to live.
Thank you, Mr. Constant. Are there any questions, Mr. Constant? Okay, thank you very much for your
thank
testimony.
You.
I should note it's now on my tablet here that we do have Director Tracy Dompling from Division of Behavioral Health in the room available for questions. We have one more invited testifier, and that is Mr. Dustin Larna, CEO of the Residential Youth Care in Ketchikan. And initially I thought they were going to be in the room, but I believe Mr. Larna is on the phone. Mr. Larna, are you there? Can you hear me?
Good afternoon. This is Dustin Larna from Residential Youth Care in Ketchikan. I am on the phone instead of in person.
Wonderful. Would you please put yourself on the record and provide your testimony?
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. As I said, Dustin Larna with Residential Youth Care in Ketchikan. Man, I got to go last, so these guys have said everything I had on my list I've kind of scratched out as they've gone along. But I would like to clearly voice my support for Senate Bill 45. A little bit of background for me, I've been involved in providing children's behavioral health services in Ketchikan to young people and families from all across the state for more than 20 years. During that time, I've worked with several different administrations, worked through lots of different initiatives to change and update regulation, you know, other projects like Bring the Kids Home and just other initiatives to try to improve behavioral health for young people in Alaska. And I can say that I believe Senate Bill 45 has the ability to impact behavioral health access and services in a bigger way than anything I've been a part of in the past. This issue, this need for evaluating parity, I think is really important. And one thing I want that I try to share around that is I believe that many of the regulations and rules that we operate under today are really outdated and a product of the past. They're a product of being originally developed during a time when there was doubt in a lot of people's mind that mental health and substance abuse services did any good. Some of them come from a time when accessing care was so stigmatized that people in general weren't even willing to admit that they needed help. This is from a time when you just picked yourself up by your bootstraps and and mental health challenges weren't part of an open conversation. Over time, we keep trying to update different rules and regulations to improve care, and we just don't really get there the way we've been doing it. This parity bill would give the opportunity to go back and look at, like, open things up and look at, why do we do things the way we do? It's an opportunity to ask the question, is there any value in this regulation when it comes to providing quality care? And I think the answer will help us uncover these non-quantitative treatment limiters that everybody has talked about today. A couple of examples that I want to share. The documentation requirements to provide behavioral health services to youth and families is a massive burden on organizations and providers that adds significant costs. So there's a ton of time spent in organizations trying to meet these different documentation requirements that literally drive providers away from accepting Medicaid or working for agencies that do accept Medicaid. It reduces the number of Alaskans that can be served with the resources we currently have in place, and in some cases actually decreases the quality of our service. Treatment plans has come up, and that's a kind of a hot topic for me for the last several years. Treatment plans under Medicaid requirements and behavioral health requirements that we have in place are designed to include all kinds of information that don't mean anything to the youth and families we serve. If you're going to put together a treatment plan to be able to communicate with the folks that you serve and the people providing services, it should really be specifically designed to communicate that plan with the people you serve. Our young people, when you list out every specific behavioral health service you're going to provide, how many units you're going to provide, what the billing codes are for all those units, when you list all of that information out as it's required now, you can end up with a treatment plan that's 15 pages long that you're asking youth and families to sign off on. And so that document, not only is it a burden to try to develop and get signed the way it's currently required, but it actually has struggles to meet the need of actually communicating what's going on with the most important people. It ends up serving as a document that you keep in your record so that if you get audited down the road, you can prove that you documented the services you were going to bill. That's one example of a specific non-quantitative treatment limiter. Another thing that I like to point out that is a question I think people should continue to ask is, in Alaska, my understanding is there are over 300 licensed behavioral health providers in private practice. The last number that I have heard from anybody is that 8 of those over 300 private practice providers accepted Medicaid. That's really alarming to me when we know it's been identified that our Alaskans are underserved, that we don't have the capacity to meet people's needs in our state, yet out of hundreds of private practice providers, 8 will accept Medicaid. And that has to do with rates of reimbursement. It has to do with this administrative burden process, being able to be enrolled as a provider, be reimbursed appropriately. So I think that's a good indicator to look at. If nobody in private practice is willing to provide Medicaid-funded behavioral health, it highlights some pretty big problems in the system.
Mr. Lorna, I apologize. we are running a little low on time here. I think we do have a – to get to read that. I think we have a question. Vice Chair Giesel.
Thank you. I actually wanted to ask the director about that last statistic that was presented for verification.
Thank you. Director, if you mind putting yourself on the record.
Absolutely. Thanks. Tracy Domthing, Director of Division of Behavioral Health. I don't know exactly if the statistic is accurate. I can say, I mean, we can certainly provide this group with the number of behavioral health providers that we have. We do know that Medicaid reimbursement is certainly lower than what most private organizations can receive for similar services. We know that that in and of itself is a barrier. Even just being a Medicaid provider does open folks up to potential audits from the Medicaid side of things. And what we've heard to as reference of, you know, clawing back the funding that has been, you know, provided for services or for those claims if there's inaccuracies that are found later. And so those are things that are challenging for private providers. I don't think that's unique to Alaska.
Thank you. Senator Giesel?
Yes, thank you, Director. You are undergoing rebasing, however, I understand. How close are we to completing that and reestablishing the fees or the reimbursement?
Sure, through the chair, Senator Giesel. I think within behavioral health, we should have within the next month or two some numbers to be able to go back to behavioral health providers and also to look at the department. We had originally hoped to have those numbers before session started, but one of the things that had been communicated to us, even through the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, was that the surveys and other types of things that we were asking providers to complete was pretty lengthy and very detailed, and there was a lot of things going on at that time that were competing priorities, and so they had asked for some additional time to be able to complete that. We did have a conversation knowing that we had wanted to have things ready before session to be able to see how much traction we could get, but it was one where we really did side on trying to provide the providers more of that support to be able to take the time to get full information provided as part of that rate methodology review.
Very good. One other question, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Senator Giesel.
Did you say that you could provide us with the number of clinicians who were available?
Through the chair to Senator Giesel, we can share with you the number of Medicaid, behavioral health Medicaid providers that we have currently enrolled.
All right. And could you, I don't know if you're able to do this, but provide the number based on category, clinical counselors, social workers, advanced nurse practitioners?
Through the chair to Senator Giesel, yes. And it would probably break down even further into with the 1115 demonstration waiver, there are things, behavioral health clinical associates, there are folks that are involved or certified and enrolled as peer supports as well. So we can break that down.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. So, Senator Hughes, this question for the director or for the testifier? I think if you're sorry with you, I think I'd let the testifier go and then we can call the director back up. Is that okay? Mr. Larna, do you have any closing thoughts with your testimony?
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. The last thing I wanted to share is that, and I think Lance hit on this, is like our current administration has been great in you know, helping look at some of these things that we've been communicating about. But I do think it's important to move forward with this legislation because it, like Lance said, this gives the framework for us to continue to this effort through other people, through different administrations.
Thank you, Mr. Larna. Any closing questions? I don't see any. I appreciate your testimony. Director, I'm sorry I do this, but do you mind coming back up? And Senator Hughes has a question for you.
Thank you very much. This is a very compelling topic and something that is very timely as far as being addressed. And but one of the things that's stunning to me is this has been on the books at the federal level for 17 years. And here we're talking about how we haven't been complying with it. Definitely there's systematic problems with the processing. I do, you know, I wish there were a cure-all, but for those behavioral health providers out there, I heard from the medical side this morning that they're having trouble with reimbursements from back to 2022. So this isn't a cure-all. However, we do need to take steps for this because especially with our youth, I think it's a pressing issue. But I'm wondering, when I look at the bill, and I appreciate the sponsors' efforts and trying to address this, what we actually are doing is telling them comply with a law that's been on the books 17 years. I know it was updated a couple years ago. And then we're asking them to do a one-time report and then to do an annual report. And, of course, part of that is looking at regulations and things that might get changed and then going and getting a new changes approved through the Medicaid plan. But do you have, Director, do you have are you confident that this bill will actually solve our problem, and do you need the bill to solve the problem, or could you, and for 17 years, shouldn't we have been making adjustments and doing this? And because I hear we have about a half a million dollar fiscal note to this, and it's going to take work, and maybe we do need these reports to hold the division accountable to do this, but I am just wondering, and then adding on that as far as that fiscal note, there's about $325,000 annually for these annual reports to help with the assessments, and then that one-time report, unless I'm reading the bill wrong, I think you have to do that one-time report, which also includes a market analysis. So just wondering if that $325,000 is enough to do that in that first year when it's the same amount for future years for reports that don't necessarily have the same things the one-time report has.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I'm going to try to get all of your questions in there. See if, and so feel free to ask again if I don't hit them all. I think the biggest question being, you know, do we need the legislation to do the work? No. I certainly hear the provider concern that just because I'm in this position, Commissioner Hedberg's in her position, Deputy Commissioner Ricci, that we're all very passionate about this. In 2 years, this could look considerably different. So I understand the desire to get something into statute that requires the department to look at parity. Part of the issue with parity, the specific federal regulations that have been identified are based on a Medicaid managed care organization structure. The state of Alaska is a fee-for-service Medicaid structure. Mm-hmm. So there are some challenges trying to make the managed care and the fee-for-services come together if we specifically go line by line by line by line, because there are just things that are not comparable. So what the chair has really asked us to do is to be able to get with, and you mentioned this too, is with the Alaska Behavioral Health Association to really get into the regulations and identify what are the priorities, where are the priorities, and really focus in on what would be some amendments that we could add to really enhance that and solidify that need to continue to work now and in the future in those specific areas.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes.
I guess follow-up, because the $325,000 for the annual reports, is that adequate then for the extra information in that one-time report?
Through the chair, to Senator Hughes, at this point we do. We did reach out to two of our contractors that work with us on Medicaid-related activities. One was a little lower, one was a little higher. We went in the middle as far as what we might be looking at for that. I could be wrong, when I was looking at this bill, it looked like this was a one-time report. And so, yes, that would be sufficient for a one-time report and full deep, you know, dive review. You know, if it's for continuing years, I just may need to do some updates for the fiscal note.
Thank you, Director. Thank you, Senator Hughes. I'll note that, as the Director said, my hope is that the Behavioral Health Association and the Department will work on this and perhaps at least discuss amendments with the possibility of doing a CS, but we don't intend to move this quickly. We want to get it correct. With that, we're done with invited testimony, so I'm going to take us off the record for a moment so that we can set up for the next bill hearing. back on the record. We are now going to take up SB 44, and I apologize to Senator Kleeman. Did not mean to shortchange you on time, but we had some testifiers on the last bill that had sort of time constraints and had to go first. So we'll try to get through here. I'm open to extending the meeting by a few minutes if my colleagues are. Senator Kleeman and your staffer, Brianna Kakaruk, if you could please provide introductory comments for Senate Bill 44. Oh, I'm sorry. Before you start that, I should acknowledge earlier we're joined by Rep. Dibert. Maxine Dibert has been in the room for us for much of this hearing. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Senator Kleeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Matt Kleeman, Senator for District H in West Anchorage. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 44 today. In 2022, the United States Department of Justice investigated Alaska's behavioral health care system for youth. The DOJ investigation found an over-reliance and institutionalization to treat minors with behavioral health disabilities in Alaska. In response to these findings, the Department of Health embarked on the Behavioral Health Roadmap Project for Alaska Youth in the fall of 2023. My office recognizes and appreciates the steps that the department, behavioral health providers, and other stakeholders across the state put into regional meetings and their drafted report. I hope that together we can make meaningful progress in caring for Alaska's youth in the most appropriate setting along a continuum of care. There remains an urgent need for transparency and parent-guardian involvement at the psychiatric hospitals that serve Alaskan youth with behavioral health needs. Senate Bill 44 enhances and protects the rights of these young patients who undergo evaluation or inpatient treatment at these psychiatric hospitals. Senate Bill 44 has four main objectives. First, to ensure that youth patients have access to at least 1 hour of communication with their parent or legal guardian each week. Second, to ensure that the Department of Health conducts twice per year unannounced inspections of facilities providing residential treatment to youth psychiatric patients, in which 50% of all youth patients are interviewed about their experiences. Third, to ensure that every time seclusion or restraint is used on a youth patient, it's reported within 24 hours to the Department of Health and to the patient's parent or guardian. And fourth, to enhance transparency by requiring the Department of Health to prepare an annual report regarding minors in psychiatric hospitals and publish that report for the public to view. With that, thank you for your time and consideration today. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have. And now my staff, Brianna Kakaruk, will provide a sectional analysis of the bill.
For the record, my name is Brianna Kakaruk, and I'm staff to Senator Kleeman. Section 1 amends AS 4730-840 by adding a new section to ensure a minor undergoing evaluation or inpatient treatment at a psychiatric hospital has the right to have regular confidential video communication with a parent or guardian unless otherwise prohibited by law or court order. Section 2 amends AS 4732-39 by adding new subsection E and F. Subsection E requires the Department of Health to prepare an annual report regarding minors in psychiatric hospitals, to publish the report on the department's website, submit to the Senate Secretary and Chief Clerk of the House of Representatives, and notify the legislature of its availability. Subsection F requires the Department of Family and Community Services to collect data on minors who receive residential psychiatric care at psychiatric hospitals and submit it to the Department of Health for their report. Section 3 amends 4732-110, subsection C, to authorize the officer or employee of a department with licensing authority to enter for any purposes described in new subsection D. Section 4 amends AS 4732-110 by adding a new subsection D to require a designated agent or employee of the Department of Health to conduct at least twice a year unannounced inspections of each psychiatric hospital where minors undergo evaluation or inpatient treatment in which a minor has spent more than 3 nights in the preceding year. At these inspections, the designated agent or employee must interview at least 50% of the patients. Section 5 amends 4732 200 by adding new subsection G to require a psychiatric hospital to send written notification of each use of seclusion or restraint on a minor to the Department of Health and the minor's parents or guardian within one business day after the use of seclusion or restraint. And section 6 sets the effective date of July 1st, 2025. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question about the definition of physician that is in this legislation before us. And I ask this because I just want to, and it's on page 2, line 1, that I'm referencing the overseeing physician. I'm curious because I'm unclear if in these facilities that there may be a clinical psychologist or an advanced nurse practitioner who also has a degree in psychiatric nursing that might be the person overseeing the care. And is this definition inclusive of those individuals who might also be monitoring the treatment of these individuals or these children?
So just for clarification of the question, and this is Senator Matt Klayman, you're asking not so much the definition that's there for physician, but you're actually asking the overseeing the physician as qualified by the overseeing adjective or the not adjective but the modifier or not?
I apologize. Let me clarify my question. So I see it says approved by the overseeing physician in this legislation, and I want to know what does that mean? Who is the overseeing physician and what is included in that definition? Is it inclusive of all the folks that might be identified as an overseeing physician? So in some treatment facilities, they might have a clinical psychologist as the person who is providing and overseeing the care. That's not necessarily someone who is licensed under the state medical board. They're licensed under the state psychiatric board. Does that hopefully clarify?
Through the chair, it actually may be an area in which we may want to have further discussion. I believe the way the overseeing physician is drafted in this version of the legislation is that, for example, in the Alaska Psychiatric Hospital, one of the facilities this would apply to, I believe the overseeing, the person in charge of medical care has always been a physician. That doesn't mean that a specific care to a particular patient may not be a clinical psychologist or another provider. And I believe the way this has been drafted would mean that if you were going to essentially say for a youth that they don't think the youth should be allowed, they shouldn't require the youth shouldn't be required to talk to their parent under the terms of the bill, that would have to go up to the physician in charge of the whole operation before that could be approved. I think that's how the bill is drafted, not the overseeing of the care, but overseeing of the facility. But if there's interest on the committee that a mid-level clinical provider who's supervising the care of a particular patient should have that authority to say this particular patient would not benefit from talking to their parents for an hour a week, I think that's a reasonable approach to take. But I believe we have the way the bill is drafted is that overseeing person is the person in charge of the facility, the medical provider.
Senator Tobin, you have a follow-up. Then we have Senator Giesel in the queue.
I do. Thank you. And I ask this question because in page 1, line 11 of the bill, it says whether that overseeing physician might consider it therapeutically unadvisable. And in my interpretation, that would be someone who is directly overseeing the care of the child who would have the insight about whether that would be therapeutically advisable or inadvisable. Thus, that might not necessarily be someone with an MD degree, but have some of these other degrees.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So probably about 4, maybe 5 years ago, we did expand the clinicians, not mid-levels, clinicians who can provide care in psychiatric hospitals to include physician assistants and advanced nurse practitioners.
Right.
So you might check on what the definition is in here. And if you intend only physicians, there could be an amendment offered. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Do you have any comments to that, Senator Klayman?
No, we'll look into that in more detail because that was actually, as Senator Tobin had let us know in advance, that was a question, and we'll make sure because I think that's the policy question, and to the extent that the drafting doesn't necessarily track those intentions, we can either work. I'm not wedded to the notion that the managing or the supervising physician of the whole facility approves those, but I can also see if you're going to start saying in the clinician's or in the treatment provider's view that it's not advisable to have the parental contact, I also don't mind the notion that that should be an exception and that the person that's asking for that exception needs to get that signed off one level higher up. It doesn't, I tend to think it would be unlikely that person in charge would not approve that, but I also think in the world of checks and balances, when we're essentially saying, oh, youth, you're not going to talk to your parents for the next week or more, that should be a carefully considered decision and shouldn't just be a routine kind of choice made.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And in that same section, I'm just curious why we would limit in statute that not more than four occasions, and if, for instance, the person supervising their therapy would like them to have daily video communications, would this limit it by we're saying for at least one accumulative hour, but not over four occasions? Is there some reason to limit that, or
through the chair, Senator Hughes? That's meant to be a minimum, not a maximum. And so if the care could – they could allow far more, but the issue would come in if somebody wasn't at least getting the minimum.
Follow up?
Senator Hughes.
I'm reading it, and I understand the 1 hour is a minimum, but the phrase over not more than four occasions seems to limit it. And so if the overseeing physician or clinician says, I think it would be good for them to have leeway to have it as often as possible or daily or whatever, it seems like this would limit it not more than four occasions. So I just think that I think that language should maybe be removed.
If I could offer, Senator,
Senator Dunbar, absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Maybe I'm misinterpreting, but on line 10, it's has the right. The minor has the right. So a right is sort of, as Senator Klayman said, the floor. So they have the right to assert these an hour or four occasions. But if the facility says we want more, this doesn't limit the facility's ability as I read it. But is that your interpretation, Senator Klayman?
Mr. Chair, I agree exactly with your analysis.
Okay. But it's worth talking offline. I mean, I think that we're all on the same page. The issue that Senator Hughes flags is we don't want to even imply a maximum number of visits or any kind of ceiling for the facility. Do you have a follow-up, Mr. Senator
Hughes? I have a question about Section 4.
Please.
In Section 4 on page 3, we're requiring the unannounced inspector from the Department of Health to conduct at least interviews with at least 50% of the minor patients. And I'm sure that would be very enlightening as far as the information that would be gathered. I'm just wondering if you could have a set of patients where that may be very difficult for a youth to have the number of youth that could actually even sit and do an interview. I don't know how severely traumatized a youth might be and whether that is practical. Is that something that you've been in touch with the providers? Is that a reasonable thing that actually could, that requirement could be met?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, in working on this legislation, we've looked at similar legislation in other states and talked with providers, and we believe that 50% is fairly reasonable. It wouldn't be everyone that's been treated in that facility over the past year. It's the people that are then in the facility. And then the likelihood that essentially the majority of patients in the facility were in a state that they couldn't communicate with anybody is actually pretty unlikely. It doesn't mean some may be having some communication difficulties, but I think it's very unlikely that you would have 50% that were in a extreme state of psychiatric crisis that they couldn't have communications with folks.
Senator Hughes, you have a follow-up?
Yes, it would be good to perhaps have one of the someone that it works in a psychiatric hospital kind of speak to that at some point if we have that opportunity. And then, Mr. Chair, I do have a question about Section 5.
Go ahead, Senator Hughes.
I believe it was in your it was in the sponsor statement, which was pretty startling, 261 incidents in a three-month period of the use of the restraint. And, of course, parents and families might be concerned about that. And so you're trying to make sure it's only used when it's appropriate. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering right now, when it is done, is there a requirement that there's a video camera or anything on that child or youth? And do parents have a right to be able to view that video? And have you thought about that as a way to ensure that it is not abusive and that it's, you know, the parent could really see the child was needed to be restrained in order for their own safety and for care?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, we actually will need to look into that and do some research and find out. I don't know the answer to that. I would note that in the world of psychiatric treatment environments, certainly having cameras in the room all the time may have some contraindications for some patients. I mean, the notion that I'm in this, if you think about it, I'm in this padded cell and they think I'm going to hurt myself and they're watching me on the camera all the time. The paranoia components that could make it even more complicated than it already is are real issues, and I'd want to hear from providers on that. But I would have real concerns about sort of lots of cameras going all the time. But I do think we'll look into that and get an answer to you.
I'll note for the committee we have two invited testifiers, Amanda Mativier from Facing Foster Care and Carolyn Brown, who is a parent navigating the system, and I would like to get to them today. But first we'll have Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be quick and we can talk offline. As I know, we previously had a testifier who talked about ICWA and children who are tribal who are in these systems, and I'd like to expound a little bit more on page 2, line 1, about the other adult. And when we talk about ensuring that if it is an unaccompanied minor who might be a tribal member, if there's some right or responsibility for an ICWA or a member of the tribal community or a designated tribal authority to be able to have access to that child as well.
And through the chair, we're happy to talk about that with you.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. I'll note also for the committee, we have available for questions Robert Nave from the Division Operation Manager from the Division of Healthcare Services, and Chrissy Vogely, the Senior Policy Advisor for the Division of Family and Children's Services. But for now, I'd like to go on to, if you're all right with me doing so, Senator Klayman, we're going to go on to invited testimony. First up, we have Amanda Mativier, the co-founder and board member of Facing Foster Care in Alaska from Anchorage, and I believe she is online. Ms. Mativier, are you there?
Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you. Please put yourself on the record and provide your testimony.
Senator Dunbar, members of the committee, thank you for allowing time for invited testimony on this really important legislation. For the record, my name is Amanda Mativier. I'm a co-founder and a board director member of Facing Foster Care in Alaska. We're a statewide nonprofit led by current and former foster youth focused on advocacy, training and direct services to young people, and we're actually celebrating our 22nd year. I myself am a former foster youth, and I was a longtime foster parent for 15 years, off and on. My husband and I fostered teens. We had 21 youth come through our home at different points in time from all over the state, and I'm also a professional social worker, and I've worked in child welfare and behavioral health, housing sector, and higher education for 2 decades now. It feels like a long time. I'm testifying today on behalf of Facing Foster Care in Alaska and in support of Senate Bill 44. This bill offers a number of fixes to longstanding issues for children in residential psychiatric treatment facilities. And while this bill is specific to all minors who may experience residential care, foster youth often experience some form of placement in a residential facility, making it that much more pressing. And I'll also note that, you know, nearly 70% of young people who experience foster care in our state are Alaska Native or American Indian and fall under the Indian Child Welfare Act. And I know it was noted earlier by a member of the committee of kind of where that falls in. And so this does impact a lot of young people who are from or in rural areas as well. So if you followed the news, any of the lawsuits, and the investigation in recent years by the United States Department of Justice, and you may be aware of the challenges that youth face when placed in residential care facilities. I've had the honor of knowing hundreds of young people over the past two decades placed in residential care for all kinds of reasons. Maybe an acute mental health crisis, maybe a threat of suicide to get out of a foster home, or simply because there were no other alternative placement options. Youth move often hundreds of miles from their home and are separated from their family, their community, their schools, their culture, and their friends to be placed in psychiatric facilities. With this comes limited communication with the outside world. Oftentimes things like phone visits with family or a young person's attorney or member of their case could be limited based on their behavior. It could be either incentivized or used as a punishment, where they can't have access to phone calls to their family, to the outside world, because of their behavior, or it could be used as an incentive for positive behavior. And so oftentimes communication outside of these facilities, once again, people are in, is very limited. If you've ever tried to call a residential facility to talk to a young person, you would know that oftentimes you might need a code. You have to get that from the parent or guardian. For a young person in state foster care, that would be OCS, and so oftentimes even their own guardian ad litem or attorney has limited access to them. And really, perhaps, I think probably the most difficult piece for young people in residential care that I hear is that they're chemically and physically restrained or secluded in what is quote-unquote called a quiet room. There's a common term among foster youth that has been this way for the last 20 years. Youth use the term booty juice, and they're referring to the IM shot or the intramuscular injection, which is basically a cocktail of drugs that's used to chemically sedate children who are having what is perceived to be emotional outbursts. There's a growing effort to address a lot of the challenges, not just in Alaska, but across the country that children face when they're in these situations or in these facilities. And, I mean, I think we know as a state that we really lack community-based services, and we end up with this over-reliance on these facilities and these residential care systems, but with that comes so many challenges. So in recent years at the state level, myself, I work with young people along with the Court Improvement Program and other legal parties, and so now for young people, at least in foster care, who end up in these facilities have a mandatory appointment of an attorney. And that's a huge step in the right direction. And I feel like this legislation is the next layer to really doing the right thing. At the federal level, a law just went into effect. It's called the Stop Institutional Child Abuse Act. And so across the country, there's a growing body of evidence of a lot of the challenges that young people experience in these facilities. And so that comes with creating a federal commission that will be formed to focus on best practices. And really, as a state, we're not going to fix all the issues that youth face in these facilities overnight or even meet the need to, you know, be able to create community-based services where we're lacking. But I think the sponsor of SB 44 and the House bill on the companion bill on the House side has really made a concerted effort in drafting this legislation to focus specifically on transparency and communication that will put Alaska on the right path. And so this bill does several things. It requires those twice annual inspections with the effort to talk to 50% of the patients and interview them.
Ms. Mativier, I'm sorry. We're running a little low on time, and I do want to get to the parent as well and hear her testimony. Would you maybe be able to add a couple of closing thoughts?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll say that this bill really fosters the both transparency and communication that is clearly a therapeutic intervention. So for a child to be able to communicate with their parents, members of their team, the outside world, again, it's a step in the right direction. So I would urge you all to pass SB 44. There's young people who are also behind this to foster really increased communication and transparency. And thank you for making the time for invited testimony.
Thank you very much, Ms. Mativier. And I'll say, if you have additional comments, please submit them to the members or to the committee in written form. Next up, we have Ms. Carolyn Brown. She's a parent navigating her child's psychiatric treatment. Ms. Brown, can you hear me?
Hi, can you guys hear me okay?
We can. Please put yourself on the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Caroline Brown. And so for members, good afternoon, and thank you so much for the opportunity to testify in support of this important bill. My family and I live in Fairbanks. And before I start, I actually just want to say that I'm really glad to hear your previous testifier. She and her organization has been a tremendous help, and they do fabulous work. So listen to every word she has to say. Thinking about psychiatric care for minors was never something that my husband and I ever thought of when we contemplated having a family so many years ago. We became foster parents in 2012, and we welcomed an amazing little two-year-old boy into our family at that time. Ultimately, we were able to adopt him when he was 3 and a half. He's now 14. It was clear from the beginning that he needed a lot of support because of the abuse and neglect experienced as an infant and toddler. As parents, we got to work making sure he had those supports, including regular therapy, occupational therapy, so many evaluations, medication support when it became clear that that was needed, and ultimately psychiatric care. That last support began with regular appointments with a pediatric psychiatrist when that finally became available in Fairbanks, which is just only 2 years ago, and ultimately residential treatment in a psychiatric hospital. When your kid struggles in this way, it's hard, and it's often an emotionally and physically exhausting journey for every member of the family. I provide this background of my own family to just give a hint of what's involved for parents and guardians. In our experience with psychiatric hospitalization of our child, and his time at other residential treatment centers, we've luckily never been denied access to our son. Regular contact has been critical to his treatment and his overall well-being. Kids need to know that they are not forgotten, that their families are in their corner every single day. We have been largely, but not always, been able to regularly have contact through calls and visits, but we've worked really hard to make that happen. And not every parent has the resources or capacity to advocate so fiercely. Many families need the structural support that this bill will provide to assure their ability to have contact with their kids in order to support them. I cannot stress this enough. We also appreciate the inclusion in this bill to keep parents and guardians informed of any use of seclusion or restraint. Within a day, parents can provide their kids an opportunity to process those experiences, but only if they know about them. We haven't always gotten that clear and timely communication, and it compounds the challenges that kids experience in treatment. So once again, my husband and I really support SB 44 and hope to see it become law. And so thank you for the work that you continue to do on behalf of Alaska's kids and their families.
Thank you very much, Ms. Brown. Are there any questions? I don't see any, so that's perfect in terms of timing. Senator Klayman, perhaps we can hold your closing thoughts till after public testimony on Thursday, if that's all right? Okay, so the next meeting of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will be on Thursday, January 30th. We'll be hearing public testimony on this bill, SB 44. We will also have a presentation from the Department of Health on the Medicaid 1115 waiver. And for the committee members' awareness, we'll also have an update from the Department of Family and Community Services next Tuesday. So thank you, everyone, for a productive hearing. The time is now 4:59, and this hearing of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.